Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock on a Tuesday, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And I am now here, and I'm so honoured that I've got this this gentleman on the channel today. I'm here with an absolute legend when it comes to the UK magic scene, and that is Russ Stevens. Hey Russ, how you doing?
Hey, how are you, Craig?
I'm great, and I'm so excited that you found time, because I know how busy you are, and we'll get to that a little bit later on. But
I'm very, very lucky at the moment. So yeah,
you're one of the only people in the magic industry that's really busy at the moment, which is.
I know, and I'm very aware of that as well. So,
thank you very much for finding time to speak. And first of all, congratulations on your new role at Britain's Got Talent.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's kind of a bigger role within the show. So yeah, I'm very happy with it all. Yeah. And this year was excellent. You know, we had a good year for magic again. So yeah, it's been very good.
And you know what? I'd love to talk about Britain's Got Talent in a bit. But first of all, for people that don't know who you are, can we talk a little bit about where you started in magic? Because I know that you won the Magic Circle Young Magician of the Year when you were 16.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you got into magic like way before that. When did kind of the magic bug bite
you? I did the usual get a magic set at Christmas from my aunt. I was 8 or 9, so it's a long time before Young Magician of the Year. And that was always hooked on it. And then it kind of expanded from there. And then my hero when I was a kid, all you got then was the odd TV appearance. It was a magician called Johnny Hart, who used to be on TV a lot, but he was like a 10-minute silent manipulating act. So he did doves and cards, and I was fascinated with him. So he was sort of my little hero that I used to think was amazing. And he's passed away recently, but he's, you know, still the best of that act. It was still the best I've ever seen. So with the knowledge I have now, it's still the best. So I just wanted to be him. And then I decided I wanted to get an act together. But the problem I had was, as a kid, I hated performing in front of people. I couldn't stand it. I really hated it. But then realized that if I wanted to do this act, I had to show it to people. And I wanted to enter the Young Magician of the Year, because Johnny Hart had won it the first year, which was in 1960. He was the first ever winner. And so my whole big dream was to win the Young Magician of the Year. So then I entered it when I was 14, and came nowhere. And they do it every 2 years. And then I entered it when I was 16, and I was lucky enough to win. So with a very inspired Johnny Hart, but not anywhere near as good type of act. So I did like a manipulation act with doves, a parrot, I had 2 dogs, a chicken. And back in those days, that was 1977, so back in those days, there was a career to be had driving up and down the motorway, doing proper shows in theatres. And we had these super clubs, which were like 2,000 seat cabaret clubs that would bring over sort of big stars from America and put on shows. And I was lucky enough to be with an agency that managed some really big names at the time. So wherever they went, I got thrown in as well as part of their package. So I was very lucky. Yeah, so that's how I started, really. And I've always done it. It's what magic is. That's it. That's been my soul.
Your whole life.
Yeah.
And you said that when you entered Young Magician of the Year, it was a very manipulation-based act. How did you progress from that to illusions? Because one of the things that you're most well-known for, especially in the magic community, is mystique.
Yeah.
How did you go from Russ Stevens, the manipulator, to Russ Stevens, the illusion act?
So I was doing the manipulator, the small act, and I realised I wanted to make it bigger. But what I never, because I was so obsessed with that kind of magic, which was the non-talking, I never really concentrated on what I should have done, which was the speaking. So I was still this silent 12-minute, 15-minute act. You know, it's quite amazing, really, that I could have a career doing that in the UK. And I decided, I'd like to try and do an illusion. And the first one I got was the broomstick suspension. and it was with a mic stand. I didn't want to do it with the brooms, and I did, oh, I'd do it with a mic stand and to make it a little bit different. And I always remember, I remember I asked as a kid, so I must have been 20, something like that. And I remember asking Addie Bongo, I wanted to, I'll tell you when it was 1981. So how old was I then? 21. So I remember asking Addie Bongo one day, I think probably in Davenport or something, because I'm originally born in London. And I remember asking him, oh, why don't magicians use songs to their magic? Because I wanted to use In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins, because I just thought it would just like really fit. And I remember him just saying, oh, no, magicians don't use songs. Don't use that. Whatever the answer was, it never made any sense. And so I kind of started doing illusions and stuff like that with the odd vocal track, which up till then hadn't. Copperfield had just started as well, and he's slightly older than me. So I suppose maybe I saw him on some of those early specials and that might have pushed me. I can't remember, but yeah. And so that was the first illusion. And then in 1987, I got, there used to be a disco, like a nightclub in London called Zenon's, and all the magicians of the day, the silent guys, used to work there. So Duncan Trillo used to do it. I used to do it. An act called the Zodiac Brothers, which was Paul Keeve and a guy called Lawrence Layton. They used to do it a lot. And you could go on and do a 10-minute act. And it was like in between, well, they'd all be dancing. And then all of a sudden, the lights would hit the stage and on you walked. Kind of. So it was a real tough gig, but the magic used to go really well. And they approached me in the Christmas of 87 and said, we want to produce a leopard on stage. Can you produce a leopard or a leopard? And I'd never done anything like that. And of course, I am the kind of person that will always just say, not yes, but if it's a challenge, the logistics won't bother me. I'll always go, yeah, sure, let me find out. And so I ended up going to a workshop that wasn't even a magic thing locally to where I was living then, which was in Yorkshire, and they made a cage production. And I literally went and turned up on the day, having never done it, and with this genuinely quite vicious leopard with its handler. And I remember we did a rehearsal and I pulled the cloth away to produce it at the end of the act. And the handler, I always remember him saying, when you do it tonight, don't pull the cloth over. Don't pull it off from there. Pull it off from another point. And I've got it on video somewhere. Yeah, they videoed it. And sure enough, when I pulled the cloth off, there he was waiting to kind of go for I think it's madness. But anyway, so I did that. But the brilliant thing about it was I got a video out of it. And because it was in London, it was the West End, and it was on New Year's Eve, it was full of tourists. So it was like you had a really big, like, American vibe crowd in the audience. And so I'd heard about this show called Mystique that the Blackpool Pleasure Beach were thinking of putting on. And at that point, they used to do a summer shows called the Viva Shows. And they had this amazing reputation for their production values, and that they decided to do a Viva show with magic, which became Mystique. And I heard about this and I just submitted my video. And they thought I was English, but they thought I'd been performing in America. So they fell for this. They thought I was some big illusion guy from America that was English, but I'd obviously been performing in Vegas or somewhere. And so the video was what got me Mystique, basically. And I kind of blagged my way in because that's all I had. I had a microphone stand suspension and a little act. So, yeah. And I remember them, the first ever meeting with the choreographer and the director was, we don't like magic and we're only putting this on because the owner of the park wants to do an illusion show, which wasn't the best start.
Not at all.
Yeah. But it became, I was there 7 years. So it was amazing. So basically, I had all these ideas in my head. It's a bit like BGT. My skill is in production. I'm quite a good magician and I have a good knowledge of magic, but my skill is in directing and staging magic. Like, I love music, I love lighting. That's my buzz, is staging and directing the, you know, magic. So for the first time ever, I got this opportunity with quite a big budget to put on an illusion show. And so all that they'd bought the Impaler illusion, which was the sword through the body thing. And they bought, luckily, the best one you could buy from a guy called David Mendoza in America, who used to build for Copperfield and all the main guys. So I was really lucky that I had this Amazing Illusion, and they wanted to just do it the usual way. And we ended up doing these sequences, like we had a vampire sequence, and that was part of the Impaler, and we had a James Bond routine, and everything, like, not all of it, but some of it had these little themes running through. So it was really good. And the dance numbers all fitted in with the magic. It wasn't just a dance number with a bloody magic vibe to it. It was all to fit in. Each thing complemented the other. It was really smart. I learned a lot. And the producer, the director, was a lady called Gloria G. And she was, because she didn't really know magic. So she kind of naively let me just do what I wanted. But then I had her expertise behind it, which I learned from her more than anyone about how to stage magic. So yeah, and then Mystique ran 7 years. And I became an illusionist, you know.
Was it tough keeping, obviously 7 years, but you're going to have people coming back every year. Was it difficult keeping the show fresh and coming up with new ideas? Because that's something a lot of magicians struggle with, you know.
You know what was really weird was the first Mystique ran for 3 years, and we didn't really change very much because I didn't have any illusions. So they owned the show, like, you know, they owned all the props. So, and I kind of was in a catch 22 that I'd built up this reputation as being this illusionist. All I had was a mic stand. And then I think maybe the second year, which was 89, I bought an Impaler from David Mendoza, which cost a fortune at the time. And because I became known for that trick, like over here, I was one of the first people doing it. So I became known for doing that trick. And then subsequently, each year, I would buy illusions. And by complete luck, the first year of Mystique, Wayne Dobson's like a really good mate, and we're of similar age. And Wayne, in the January of 88, I got Mystique. And at the same time, Wayne rang me and said, I've got a special guest star position on Joe Longthorne, this comedy impersonator. He had his own TV special. So there were 1 hour specials with huge budgets. And Wayne was the special guest each week. And they wanted him to do an illusion. And he was like, would you be my illusion consultant? And I was like, yeah, great. And that led to a year later, Wayne getting his own TV series, which was a Saturday night ITV. And we did three series. I did two of those three series, the first two. And so we would order these illusions from David Mendoza in America that cost thousands, like a ridiculous amount of money now even. But back in, you know, it was just unreal. And basically the TV company would hate the fact that once we'd wheel them in, rehearse them for a week, sometimes less, do them on the show, put them back in the case, and then they'd go into the warehouse to be stored at the TV station. And they rang up one day to Wayne saying, these are taking up so much space, and we calculate per square foot the space is worth this much. We've got to get rid of these. And basically we would get the props for like hardly anything. So Wayne would ring me up and go, I got the cast-offs, what Wayne didn't want, or what he had tried to use or used. And then, so basically I was so lucky that Wayne would offer me these illusions. I'd buy them from him and put them in Mystique. So by the time I left Mystique, we had probably 80% of the show was mine. Like, I owned the props. I don't think they kind of realized it at the time, but yeah, but the first show ran for 3 years. It was the same show, exactly. And we got repeat customers, which shows you if you put something on and it's that good, people will come back. Like, I mean, I didn't realize until, I'm not a fan of performing. Like, I mean, I never really got a buzz from doing the show. I loved magic and I loved the staging and all and that thing. I never really cared for, like, you know, when I walked off, that was it. I'd go home. I didn't really go out. The last year of Mystique, my dad said to me, why don't you go out afterwards and like sign and sell? Like, why don't you have a merchandise stand? And I was like, oh, I can't imagine anything worse than standing there. And they're going to probably all just walk by. So I never really interacted with the audience afterwards. And it was only that last year that I used to stand there and people would come out that one exit. And they were like, we come every year to Mystique. It was amazing. Like, I never realized the following that it had. And then that was when Blackpool was busy. obviously it isn't like that now, but I was lucky that the time was right, the amount of people coming in. We were 600 seats in there at the time, and we were full every night, like six nights a week. We ended up having to do matinees. You know, it was a nightclub. It wasn't a theatre show. It was a 10 o'clock in the evening illusion show that was kind of adult themed, really. It wasn't for kids. Kids could probably come and see it, but it just shows you, we didn't have a problem repeating the material.
That's great. And what advice would you give a magician who's wanting to get into illusions? Let's just assume that this whole COVID thing goes away at some point in the future.
Yeah.
What advice would you give somebody who wants to be an illusionist? Because it's a big leap, isn't it?
It's a massive leap, because I know you've done the illusions as well, haven't you, Craig? And you know the commitment and the... Where I was lucky was, I had a mic stand suspension that went in the back of my little car, and then Mystique happened, and then I did this... After a couple of years, I had this huge jump from that to where I got known for doing this huge show, and subsequently all the corporates and stuff that outside of Mystique that came in were mega gigs. So I was so lucky that I had like crew. So all of a sudden I could afford to, I had the props stored, and it would be, you know, could you pick the impaler up and take it to there and get, and the dancers. That was the worst part, is when you're an illusionist, is the extra people. And you have to manage them. You have to get the dancers. You have to, like that sword illusion, you need two guys to lift you on it. And so,
and they need to be trained.
They have to be trained. And it's like, I can't just phone up anyone and go, I've got a gig tomorrow. So it was, that was always the stressful, worst part about it, you know. And I always remember we did a duck routine in the show one year, and I used to get asked to do it at corporates, and I used to get them from the lake in Lytham, St. Anne's, with permission. I used to get the ducks and then take them back the next day. Put them in. And you can imagine in the winter catching two ducks, like me and two crew guys running around a lake trying to catch ducks. But it's stuff like that. It's so much hassle. Like, you've got to really love magic or performing or staging it, or there's got to be something about that you must have a love for it, because illusions are, and I always say, and Wayne used to say it as well, because Wayne Dobson's obviously a stand-up comedy magician, and when he started doing illusions, he said illusions are they're easy to do, but they're easy to do badly. And that's like really true. They are easy to do, but ask yourself a question: how many illusionists have you seen where you kind of watch it and go, yeah, that was really cool? Because even now I see stuff that I kind of makes me cringe that they're still doing the Captain Fantastic stuff, you know, still. And I kind of did that, but it was in the early 90s. And I kind of used, I think, how you look, and if you can move, you've got all that with illusions that people don't realize either. You've got to be able to move. You've got to look right doing it. Otherwise, unless you're doing comedy. And there's so many that I look at and just go, you know, straight from the get-go, it's like, you don't really look right, you know. And I was always very aware, like, now I'm retired, but back in the day, I was like, I was doing that show, and the show was probably a two-hour show, and it was very physical. If I wasn't on stage, I was running upstairs, doing a quick change, coming down. And even then, I was like, I was in the gym 5 days a week doing aerobic exercise more than, I was so fit, like so fit. I think Chris Kenner, David Copfield's producer, what advice would you give an illusionist what would they spend $10,000? Is that $10,000 to spend? What would you tell them to spend it on? And he said a treadmill, which I think's brilliant, because there are so, you know, that's part of the job. And most magic isn't like that, you know. There's so much to it, and there's so, to me, I've done on BGT, I think my skill on there is that, like this year's final, all of those magicians were different to each other. They were different styles of magic. You know, you had little Aidan, who was like funny little kid, and you've got Magic Bones doing a slick illusion. You've got Damien O'Brien doing street type magic vibe. And they were all so different in their own. And then James and Dylan, that kind of, you know, but if you look at them all, you'll see they've all got like some kind of theatrical thing going on. There was always some kind of theatrical thing going on, whether it was a little Aidan doing his comedy thing, it was still staged in a theatrical way. And that's really my skill. That's like what I learned from the days of doing all those illusions.
And I want to talk to you about BGT, but before we do, and before we get off the illusion side of things, you've mentioned several times your skill is with lighting and sound and staging. And that's something that a lot of magicians, they completely overlook, especially if they're coming from a close-up background and they're starting to do a cabaret show. They completely forget about it. They don't think about that at all.
Yeah.
Can you give some advice very quickly, just a couple of minutes, on the basics that people should do? Let's assume that somebody is a close-up magician. They want to put a new string to the bow. They want to put a cabaret show together. Yeah. Not illusions, just a stage show they can offer people. What should they be thinking of?
So the one thing I'd say to any act is that music can add production to a trick. Like, even if you're in a little village hall, if you've got a piece of music, even if it's just background, and you use it at the right time, and it's the right piece of music, and creates the right atmosphere, that can really help, like any magic, even comedy magic. You know, I've always, if you watch BGT Final, there wasn't an act in their music behind them. Mm. You know, and that's my thing. Like, I love music. Like, I still love, and the music I listen to, I know a magician recently, a young magician, got in my car and he was laughing at what was on my Spotify that was playing. I think it was Stormzy or something. But I listen to everything. Like, I'm quite old now, but my music tastes, I kind of really like everything. That isn't some desperate old guy. I just love music. I really love music. So that comes over on the show. You know, on BGT, all that music was my, like, nearly all of that music that was on the band. Behind the magic.
How do you pick the right music out?
I think that's a bit of a talent, like having an ear.
Yeah.
So right now I'm obviously working on BGT 2021. So right now I just found a track of music for a trick that I thought, we've not done that on BGT. But what would that be? You know, how would we do that on the live shows? So, but it's perfect. And I'm like, yep, that music fits. And I know I'll stay with that music. It won't change. So if I do that on the live shows, which won't be till June or May next year, I'll probably still use that piece of music. I'm pretty good with music. I just love music and listening to it. It's having an ear, isn't it? But if I was to say, if someone was doing like a patter act, literally, no matter what it is, at a certain point, even if it's just at the end for the build-up or for the reaction at the end, a piece of music coming in is just makes it 10 times stronger.
That's great advice, that is. Let me ask you a question, Russ. Can we talk a little bit about RSVP?
Yeah, sure.
When you were still performing at the time,
yeah,
up RSVP, and I think we have to acknowledge that you were behind some of the most monumental instructional DVDs for magicians.
I had a few of the early ones.
Eye candy, more eye candy.
The Martin Sanderson thing, for me, I did the first one I released was Corporate Close-Up, Martin Sanderson. Any magicians there, if you haven't got it, get Corporate, if you're a close-up worker. But it's everything everyone does now. And they didn't used to do. You know, everyone did used to do OmniDeck, but Martin had like routined it into like an ambitious card. And the OmniDeck was never done. He used to just switch it in, which is how everyone does it like Martin, everyone. But so many people don't know that was Martin's. That was like, it wasn't the original OmniDeck. You know,
yeah, and he had a couple of cover cards on top, didn't he?
Yeah, it was done like it was a solid deception, wasn't it? The Paul Harris thing. But Martin just, I remember when he sent me the footage of the performance thing, and I had to watch it a couple of times. And again, I definitely have a good eye for magic, like the works on screen, you know. And I remember seeing the video that the OmniDeck, and I was like, wait a minute, and I rewound it, and I was like, what a fantastic premise that the. And I knew the OmniDeck, but it wasn't usually done like that. It was switched in. So, yeah, so Martin was the first ever video I filmed. And literally, There's like, do you want me to tell you a story about?
Yeah.
So I knew nothing. So basically, I was doing the illusions. I'd done a tour in Germany, and I've been, these super big, super new cruise ships had started, and they were like throwing money at some of the shows where they were booking what they thought were big shows. So I was very lucky that I did a couple of years doing these kind of ships. And it was, you know, it was amazing, but there was a lot that I didn't like. So being stuck in one place, and creatively you were kind of stuck. And my friend, my best mate is Duncan Triller, who runs Magic Week. And Duncan had done quite a lot of cruising before me. And his advice was that if you do that and you're going to do 6 months contracts, learn a skill, like spend some time, because you literally, I worked once a week. That would do two shows on the same night, once a week, a 1 hour show repeated. And the rest of the week, you're off, which sounds amazing, but it gets pretty boring. You know, it's only 6 months of laying in the sun, sounds great. But honestly, I am quite active in my brain. And so anyway, I decided I'm gonna learn video editing. And I bought one camera, they were expensive then. And I bought one camera, my wife thought I was mad. And I used to video the other act. So I'd video their first show downstairs, and then I'd video their second show in the balcony. And I would edit together, can you imagine, a singer? And I did it as well, and pretty seamlessly, two different shows singing one song, and I would edit their 45-minute shows. I can't remember, like $300 or something. I just a cursory payment. It would take me all that week, and then I'd give them a DVD at the end. And so I got a bit of a reputation for being this guy that videoed the acts, but I was really learning. And it was on Final Cut Pro, Apple Final Cut Pro, the original. And if I couldn't work out something, there was no internet. It was kind of new then. And I was stuck. I'd spend all day trying to work out how to color correct something. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, but I loved it. Because again, it's a visual thing. So I learned all those skills. And then I kind of finished and thought, well, what am I going to do with it? And then I thought, why don't I do instructional DVDs? And the only ones I knew were L&L, which were VHS tapes, and DVDs were out, and they'd been out a while, but I know that Corporate Close Up, when I did that, there weren't many DVDs out, like magic DVDs of any production, but I had no idea how to film in a studio. And so Martin, bless him, approached him. He sent me this brilliant footage from weddings by proper videographers that looked amazing, but the studio stuff, I was like, oh, I'll do it in my sitting room. And I'll get a backdrop, you know, one of those with the white backdrop. And I ended up going to Halfords and buying two mechanics work lights. anyway, so if you get the DVD, there's a bonus thing. And I think we called it Made in Japan. And the reason why was because when he came up the first time, the lights were so bright, he couldn't see. So he was like squinting throughout this whole, and I'm going, Martin, stop squinting. And he's like, the lights are bright. I didn't really know much about video lights. I just thought, oh, I can blank that, you know, put some filters over, they'll be fine. Martin ended up coming up about, he would say so, probably about four times from Surrey up to Blackpool to film Corporate Close Up, because he'd come up and I'd go, oh, you know, I think the first time we filmed it down at the Pleasure Beach in a studio there, and it was at the bottom of the rope, the Big Dipper, the big one. So the first footage, you can't hear him. Every 5 minutes, there's this roller coaster going by. So he had to come back up again. And we did it about five times. And the last time he did it, and I was learning each time. So by now I've got studio lights. So the last time he does it, it was all brilliant. It was fantastic. And like me, Martin loves cars, and he had this Subaru Impreza, like some super fast, sporty car. And it was his pride and joy. And he rang me the next morning, and literally he left my house at like 2 a.m, victorious. We finally filmed it, rang me at about 7 and said, you're not going to believe it. I was like 3 miles from home. And as I come around a corner in a country lane, a cow stepped out in front of the car. And he hit this cow, didn't kill it. Hit the car and ruined the front end, completely written off. It was like, if anything could go wrong with that video, everything that could did, but it's still one of the best videos that I ever made.
It
because
is.
Martin was such an engaging performer, you know, probably still is, but he was so engaging on that video, and his enthusiasm and my enthusiasm just wanting to make this the, and I had no knowledge of anything, and I discovered that Hocus Pocus in America bought DVDs to sell. I didn't really have any plan, and I remember they ordered, I edited a trailer and I put it up online, and I remember they ordered, I don't know, 100 DVDs, and literally within 3 or 4 hours they like were messaging me back going, we need to order some more. And that's the only time I realized, oh my god, there's like a market for this stuff. And so yeah, so that's how RSVP started, really.
But I mean, the back catalogue that you've got are some of the people that we consider today to be the top pros. You know, you've
got
Smith, Gary Jones, Chris Congreve, you know, Martin Sanderson, Daniel Chard, the list go, Sean McCree, the list goes on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah, they were really, it was a really fun times. And then I'm a really good friend of Peter Nardi's at Alakazam. So then Peter was like, would you come and shoot our DVD, you know, our stuff? And so for a good... oh, it must have been 8 years, 7, 8 years. I used to film and edit all of Peter's stuff as well. So, yeah, it was brilliant for me because I got to the point where I was probably about 40, so let me see, yeah, like 40 years old, something like. And I realised that as an illusionist, I was always aware of, like, the whole thing of how you look. And I didn't want to be this fat, aging bloke jumping around like an idiot doing that. And so I always knew I wanted to stop, like, at the right time. And I had one of the last gigs I got, it sounds bragging, but it's not. It was I got a gig at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas for a big corporate, and it was a huge show. And I took out a whole crew, and Duncan Petrillo, as kids, we always wanted to go to Vegas. We never did. And then life got in the way and he had kids and I did, and we never went. And I was like, look, I've got this gig in Vegas. Come out, be my magic advisor. And then we would have a week's holiday out in Vegas afterwards. And he said it was the most stressful thing he's ever been around. But I remember I did the gig. It was just a one-night show, but we were there probably 5 days before, and we shot all this stuff in London. And we did the gig, and I remember walking off stage, going back to the room with Duncan and saying, that's it, I'm stopping, I'm going to finish now. And he always said, oh no, you'll go back to it. And I never did. I had some gigs in the diary. That wasn't the last show, but that was when I decided. And the reason why was, one of the reasons, I wanted to be home, but I've always wanted a dog, and I never had a dog. Sounds stupid, huh?
So yeah, I've got three dogs. I know how.
They're like my life. So I'm kind of like, so I got our rescue dog, our first dog, Hoover, and who was amazing, like life-changing for me. And so I've been home since. And then that was how RSVP kind of flourished, because I was at home and I wanted to be home. And I really enjoyed that. And I stopped performing.
And was that a difficult decision to take, like, you know, to go from performing literally your whole life, you know, it's all you've done, to kind of making that decision, right, I'm at the top here, literally at the top, done.
No, I just said that was it. And because a lot of stage performers love being on stage, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I didn't have that. So when I stopped, I didn't miss it at all. But the creative thing, I think if ever I had that taken away, then that would hurt me more than having the performance side of things. So that's why, like, my job now with BGT is a hugely creative thing endeavor. And I'm pretty much been a one man band down there as well with all the magic. So, which I love, but it's a lot of work. And creatively though, it's really, really good.
Well, I want to talk about BGT next, but let me ask you one question first. As a magic producer, and to be clear, for those people that are newer into magic, when you were doing RSVP full-time, you were considered one of the top magic producers in the world. You know, you were bringing out the best DVDs.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
No, you really were. I mean, I just knew that when at Blackpool, for example, at the Blackpool convention, if I went over to your stand, I was going to see something amazing.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Thank you.
And it wasn't pipe dreams. It wasn't stuff that you couldn't do. You attracted artists that were...
Yeah, I always, if you look at our back catalogue, like you said, it was Lee, Gary, Martin Sanderson. They were all like workers. And all I've ever... I love performing a performance of magic. So I love watching good performers, generally. But in magic, nothing better to me than watching a great performer, whether that's stage close-up, you know, like, yeah, I can watch all kinds of magic and love all kinds of magic. I don't just like stage. There are some close-up magicians that I know. One very famous American magician that I once asked, why don't you go and see the shows? Like, well, you never go and see the shows. You go, I have no interest in stage magic. And that kind of like blows me away because I just have an interest in magic.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love watching. There's crap in everything, but there's also genius in everything. So like I can watch like Jan Frisch the first time and just, whoa, you know, be blown away. And then but I can also watch Yuhu Jin do his stage thing the same year or Prince of Illusion. Or I just love all magic. I don't think there's anything, I just like close-up, which I find a lot of magicians do that. They go, I only like that. And it's kind of a bit weird to me because... You know, magic's magic, and it's all brilliant if it's done well. You know, it's quite inspiring.
Well, my question would be, as somebody who's produced a lot of magic DVDs and a lot of magic products, what advice would you give somebody who's wanting to actually produce their own project or wanting to, because we do get that question a lot on this channel, you know, how do I approach a producer? How do I get them interested in what I've got to do? Is there any advice you could give somebody on that?
I think the thing where it sort of started going a bit wobbly to me was that because when I started, you know, the cameras were expensive, the lenses and all of that. And now, because technology has become as it is, you know, your iPhone can film is probably better than my original cameras, you know, and probably I've got what have I got? My iPhone is even the current one, but I bet it films a better picture than my old camera. So then everyone became a producer. And that was a problem where everyone started self-producing. And obviously, you got a wholesaler like Murphy's Magic Supplies, who pretty much, I would imagine, 80, 90% of magicians that sell stuff go through Murphy's. And they're brilliant. They're fantastic. But I found that people suddenly just were interested in... They didn't really care about the quality. They just wanted to release a product to sell, which is totally valid. You know, you want to make money. But it always mattered to me. It was a shame. You know, I used to see some really good magic, but it was bloody, really badly filmed or just cheaply done. And it was just on the, they didn't look at the bigger picture of the quality of what they wanted to do, you know. And so, when was the last project I released? Not, you know, a couple of years ago now, but I'm still sort of dip into it. I haven't had my cameras out in ages. But
That was going to be my question. Would you ever bring stuff out through RSVP? I know you're very busy at the moment, but there is ever going
to
be a time?
Yeah, I'd love to. Like a few months ago, I was sort of sending newsletters out, and obviously because I've got, like you said, an amazing back catalogue of stuff, like, and some really good effects. And a lot of the time they get cycled, don't they, where people forget about certain things and they might not have even seen that, and because they're so hooked on what the latest new toy is, kind of thing. And I definitely go back. RSVP, the site still runs. My wife pretty much runs the, we still get orders like all the time,
you know, like today. I was ordering just a few weeks ago, if you remember.
Oh, okay, right, yeah. I mean, people, you know, we're shipping out like constantly, so it's a little aside thing because I've not promoted RSVP magic at all. But it is something that I would definitely go back to, definitely. It's something that's still there, but I just haven't been focusing on it as much.
And the reason for that, and let's talk about this, is Britain's Got Talent. How did you get involved with it? Because, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but for many, many years, the magic community kind of looked down on Britain's Got Talent a bit. You saw it in the forums and on the discussion groups. Oh, Simon hates magic. You don't want to go on Britain's Got Talent. They'll make you look like an idiot. Oh, my mate went on. And now that's not, I mean, look at the final. Yeah. You know, you had five magicians and one guy who wasn't a magician, but he's close enough, you know. Yeah. And most of those came in through the public vote, and you were like the man when it came to perception of magic. How did that all come about?
The thing that was different about this year, because last year we had a lot of magicians in the final as well, but the thing that really was different was that this year four of the five magicians that reached the final were public vote, which is, that's the vote you want, you know, like, you know, the judges decide, but that's just four people. But it was just mad that four out of those five won the public vote.
Well, I actually had an interview with a motivational speaker on this channel recently, and I said, the thing with the entertainment industry, and magicians especially, is there's more demand for magic than ever before. And the thing I said as an example is, I said, look at the BGD final. Look at how many people were put into the final by the public vote. That tells me that the public want to see magic now.
I think they want to see magic when it's done well. Well, like anything, you know. And I do think with BGT, I got involved. So 2013 was the first year. And I've been working with a magician called James Moore, who did like a little a manip act. And it was always Duncan, bizarrely. Duncan had judged the Young Magician of the Year and had said to me, oh God, there was this kid on in the final. He came nowhere. And for Duncan, he was like, you know, definitely up there in the top three, but he didn't even come in the top three. And he was like, oh, you know, he could do something with him. And I'd stopped performing, but I still had all these connections and contacts. So I thought, oh, I've been putting a few acts on the cruise ships. And so I put James Moore on the cruise ships and doing this little act, but then we extended it to like a 45-minute act. And then one day he announced that he wanted to go on BGT. And like you said, I was like, oh my God, like, that is the biggest mistake ever. Don't go on BGT. It's horrific. I hate the show. I hate that they don't like magic. But in fairness, when I look back on it, and obviously the year before, I think you were there actually when David Penn did it.
Yeah. Changed the perception a bit, didn't
you? Yeah, so when David did it, that was the first guy that kind of, they went, this can be, because he got to the live shows, which I don't think had happened before. So it was definitely there to have, but I still felt like, you know, I wanted to, James basically said, I want to go on. And I said, well, you can't go on with what you've got, but let's make an illusionist. And that's what happened. And strangely enough, he's like, well, what should we do? And I said, let's do the Impaler. And that was like my signature thing from 1988. So like 20 years, 22, 20, 20 something years earlier. And that's what he did. He did the Impaler. And it's had that audition video has had, I think, nearly 100 million views now on YouTube alone. So it was like crazy. And my first meeting at Britain's Got Talent after that, when they were potentially going to put him on the live shows, was the worst meeting ever. And as in, you know, they hated the idea. They didn't understand. And I don't know why, but for whatever reason, they ended up going, okay, let's do it. And we did a thing called Table of Death, which was we hired it in. And I remember it arrived on a Wednesday. We filmed it on a Friday live on the live semi-final. I'd never done it in my career as an illusionist. James had never really done illusions apart from this Impaler illusion. And yeah, that's when the skills that I had really came into play, because we were given five dancers that I'd requested, this is what I need. And for the first time ever, that's what they kind of gave us for that period, for those days. And it was fantastic. It's still one of the best things. If you check out James Moore, Table of Death.
I remember. It was the one where there was kind of a silhouette of him.
Yeah, it was just the staging. And
it was amazing.
It required all five people to perfectly do it. It wasn't any one of those people could have completely screwed the trick up. So, and to do it live, it was live. It was a live recording as well. And there was a lot to go wrong. And considering we'd never done it, any of us had done that before, including me. And I was kind of not blagging it, because I was super confident. I knew what I was doing with the staging, but I'd never seen the prop until the Tuesday, you know. And I didn't realize, I knew I could do it, but I kind of proved to myself again, oh yeah, I can do this. And it was great, because he didn't come anywhere. I think he came fifth. To me, he should have won it, you know, won that semi-final. But he came fifth. But then they contacted me a week later on the day of the final, bizarrely, saying, we're really sorry James never went through, but you kind of like, we now understand how brilliant magic can be on the show. And, it's the first time magic that we've come together. And we've understood each other, and that was the person who wrote that is now the CEO of Fremantle in the UK. So she's like the big, huge boss.
And that's a big, important defining moment, because I remember before that point, magic was almost treated as a bit of a comedy thing. I remember that when the there was only magic on one audition episode, and it was watching all the magicians screw up, and there was like clown music over the top. And then they'd pick on one guy who'd actually.
I do think, though, in their defense, when I look back, even the pro acts that went on didn't pitch it right or do the right material, and so I actually understood why they thought it was a joke, because the magicians didn't help themselves, you know. And then I used to hear all this stuff of my act was deliberately sabotaged by them, and I can tell you that's absolute nonsense, you know, good lord, literally. It was never represented right, even when there was a good act on, and they had some proper pros on, but to me, I used to watch it, and that wasn't the right trick. Or that wasn't the right way to do it for BGT. Or maybe jumping around in your leather pants and treating the girl like she's a piece of meat maybe isn't really the way to present an illusion nowadays. Mm. There was all of that going on as well, you know, that magicians weren't seeing. But I've always had that eye for, obviously do, because I'm kind of there and I'm doing what I'm doing down there. So I do get what the public like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do get that. And that's, to me, that it changed. So in 2013, I did that, and I wasn't working on the show. And then I think the following year, Darcy Oak did it. And then that was the time when they asked me, would I like consult on the live shows for him on the semi-final, and if he got to the final, which he did. And then I did that. And then I stepped back again. And then the following year, I put Jamie Raven in, who was a close-up magician. And I had this, I just filmed RSVP Magic, a set called Pack Small Plays Massive with Jamie Allen.
Yes, I remember that.
Thinking of doing close up on stage. That DVD set's like amazing. And one of the tricks that he did was cartoon. And so I was kind of like, that would really work on BGT if we did it slightly differently and I used different music and blocked it and staged it differently. And it did. That was like mental. Like, he came second. But the audition just went viral, like, straight away. It was front page news on the Monday. You know, I remember ringing Peter Nardi and saying, Peter, just as a heads up, get some cartoons in, because I promise you, you're going to be selling a few. And I think all the dealers sold loads of cartoons. So, and then the following year after that was 2015, 2016, because I was managing Jamie Raven then as well, so I had nothing to do with BGT. I was going in like, oh, I've got an act, let's see if I can get him on BGT. So he came second, and then I was managing him, but because of that, I wasn't involved, or I couldn't work with anyone else at that time. And then we stopped working together end of 2016, and that was the year 2017 I put Izzy, who's my granddaughter. And that was the complete, you know, she as a child had watched James Moore, Darcy Oak and Jamie Raven. And it was a big part of our family thing, because I was involved. So she, you know, we'd come around and watch Saturday night BGT. And she always said, Grandpa, I want to go on BGT. And so while I was still working with Jamie Raven, they have a road show, or they used to, that would tour the country. And that was for literally members of the public. You could just turn up, queue up, show me your talent. And I took her to that, literally on the basis that she could say she did an audition. And we queued up with the public. So, you know, that thing of like, oh, it was, you know, it's his granddaughter and he's involved. We went, it's the only time I've ever been to an open audition. And she couldn't really do any magic. It was just for her to be able to say she had auditioned. That's all she wanted. I want to audition for BGT. And so that's what we did. And I remember I went downstairs and met the two or three producers who I didn't know, bizarrely, but they knew me. But anyway, it's such a big show. And one of them is now the boss. He's like the boss of the show. And he was like, okay, let's film. And I was like, no, I'm not here to... She hasn't really, just please let her show, can she show this card trick and just tell her it's great. And they couldn't film it, and she did the trick, and they went, that was amazing. And off we went. And that was like at the end of 2016, and with no intention. That was it. And then I'd literally finished managing Jamie Raven. I remember it was on a Thursday, And on the Saturday, I walked my dog thinking, oh, I've thrown everything into this thing that we were doing. We were partners in it all. And I just kind of left, and it was, you know, I was fine financially, but I was like, what am I going to do now? And then I realized, wait a minute, I wonder what would I do if I did put Izzy on? And it was 2 weeks before the last audition day. And that walk with the dog, I absolutely came up with exactly the act that she did. And then I came back, rang my daughter and said, look, I've had this mad idea. And her brother had got chicken pox literally a day or two early. So she got quarantined with us for 10 days. So she was lived with at our house. And so at night she'd come back from school and I'd written the act, you know. And so she learned that in 2 weeks. She had never properly been on stage, certainly never spoken on stage or anything like that. And we taught her the act. We rocked up on the last day of the rehearsals in Manchester, the auditions in Manchester, and did it. And the rest is kind of history. But it was as much the biggest surprise of them all was Izzy.
You know, yeah, she took the world by storm. She really did. I mean,
yeah, it's hard to be not biased because she's obviously family, but 100%, anyone that would meet her. I mean, we were just filming something for BGT, which still might be happening actually, that got postponed a couple of weeks ago, like a really big Christmas show, which Izzy, it was like the greatest ever, you know, BGT act. And they very kindly asked Izzy to be involved. And we were literally, Russ Brown was a good friend, who works on the convention, the Blackpool convention that we're involved with. And we worked together on that. And Russ used to be crewing Mystique, like back in, he came as a schoolboy asking for a summer job from, you know, could I get a summer job? And so it just shows you how long these things can last. And we were teaching Izzy a Tenkai Palm, producing these things that were part of the, literally 2 days before. And Russ was like, I've never seen someone pick it up, let alone an 11-year-old kid. She was super talented. Like, really, it's quite amazing. Like, yeah, she constantly, like, boggles us, really, with her talents, really.
She's so confident.
Without being precocious with it either. Yeah. If you met her, she's very quiet and polite. And she's very much the thing of, like, I have, that she doesn't really, if she's not performing, she doesn't miss it. It was an adventure. The whole BGT thing for us was just an adventure. And my daughter always used to say, that's what, you know, we said to her, it's an adventure. And if it stops being fun, just tell us and we'll stop. At any point, it could be, you know, if it happened on day of the final, she wouldn't have done it. So it's always been fun. And that's probably the best thing I've ever done on, you know, I remember I did Izzy and I sent all the bosses an email, and that's how I got the job actually, because I sent them an email saying thanks, because they were so brilliant. I mean, any magician I think that does it now will say how fantastic the production are and how positive, just it's a really creative bunch of people that I work with. It's a very small core team, but they all care about making that show as good as they can, you know, and they treated Izzy brilliantly. And I think the magicians this year will say the same. And I just sent them an email saying thanks on the day of the final, before the finals, just saying thanks so much. Like, just to let you know, this will never get better. Like, you know, this will never get better for me now. I've done it. Like, that was it. And that's when I got offered the job. So that's how that happened, really, where I'm probably me prompting it, saying I'm not going to be coming back because I can't better this kind of thing. And yeah, and then it ended up with, well, would you like to come and work on the show finally, which is what I've been doing now for 3 years.
And so what's your role in the show now? What's your role? I know that you work with all of the magic acts. Is that?
Yeah, my role now is like expanded more probably to cover other acts as well. Mm-hmm. Other variety, because that's my whole background, all my life has been variety. So like I think last year I had a roller skating act, what were they called, but anyway, they were brilliant. They got to the live shows as well and they were brilliant, but I kind of gave them the music and this is what I think, and this is what I think you should wear. And like, that's my thing, is like, it doesn't have to be magic. I've realized I can do it with a lot of acts, you know, like I can make them better just without even it being a magic act. I can.
So here's the big question. If you are if you're a magician watching this and your goal is to go on Britain's Got Talent, what process should they go through? You know, somebody wants to go on Britain's Got Talent. They want to do a really good job. They want to win it. What should they do? Should they just rock up to an audition? What did they do beforehand?
It's be like super prepared, That's the key. And also finding like a piece of magic that we've not necessarily the trick, the trick we haven't seen, but in the way that it's done. And a lot of magicians say to me, they talk about backstories and they think that's what the show is. And for me, if you actually look at, I could give you those magicians. So I go, James Moore, no backstory. Darcy Oak, no backstory. Jamie Raven, no backstory. Jamie Raven. So James Moore, great looking illusionist. Darcy Oak, great looking illusionist. Jamie Raven, humble, nice guy, blowing them away with strong magic, no backstory. Izzy Simpson, and a child, my God, we could have really made. I always had this thing of BGT that, and that's what the producers will say about me, is that it's the magic is what comes first. All I want to do is represent magic the best that I can with who I'm working with. That's like the biggest deal to me. So like, whether it's Izzy or it could be, you know, they'll all get that same attention. That the biggest part for me is magic. So like the most important thing of my show is my job is making people within the show respect it, which they've done, which is brilliant, and then also the public respecting it, and that's how I want it to carry on, you know. So
if somebody wants to take going on BGT very seriously, should they reach out to you and hire?
I'm on Facebook, so just privately message me but make sure it's a serious, not I've got an Omni deck routine or an ambitious card, because that's not gonna work. But it's I've got a good eye for stuff, and you know, there are tricks that I remember on the finals this year with Damien, we worked out this routine with the iPhone in the like the ball of
string,
rope thing, and I've seen like variations of that or whatever, but the way that we did it, where he had a box of memories on stage, and he, part of that were these Polaroid photos that he took out, and it was this idea of they went in the box, and then later on down at the desk he borrowed Amanda's phone after doing a trick with it, and then it visibly changed into the photos that were in that box. And that whole thing of like a phone having memories, that was how that all came about to me, was like, we use our phone to store all these memories electronically, but you know, back in the day we had photos, and I just thought it was like quite an intriguing thing to not change the phone with the photos, but the memories change places. Do you get me?
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's staging, that's not magic, that's just staging and framing it in a way that I haven't seen done before, you know. And
so it can be a trick that's been done before, but it's finding a hook, finding something that captures people's attention. And
yeah, I've got like I won't say what it is, but I've got there is a thing out there which, you know, it will appear on BGT at some point, and it's the perfect BGT, a piece of magic for BGT. It's the perfect, not just the trick, but the premise behind it and the hook and the angle. It's all about it can be like a standard, like cartoon, look at that, you know, every blooming magician had cartoon in the back of their drawer, you know. And it was thanks to Jamie Allen really that kind of made me go, oh my God, like that what an amazing big trick that can be, and how would I do that on BGT, like how would I do that? And that's, if you watch that performance, you'll see how important the staging is, and how that wasn't thrown to, that was like, you know, I'd approached Jamie Raven in about the December of that year, December, November of that year. We met up in a hotel in London, And I was like, I've got this idea. I've done two illusionists, and now I want to do a close-up guy. And so if you look at all the magicians, you've got illusionists, close-up, you've got kids, comedy magicians I've worked with that have done really well. I'm kind of like across the whole board, I seem to have a thing that I have a good eye for all of it, you know, like...
One last question on BGT, and you can put this... This has been debated on forums for as long back as I can remember, and I think you're the man to put this to bed. Does Simon Cowell hate magic?
No, he loves it. He's like the best. For instance, it is not a good idea to go down to that desk and talk about a trick. Now, don't use the word trick, because when he says, "I believe in magic," he is the kind of punter, you know. You do a close-up gig, and the best reaction is where the punter's brain just, they realise what's happened, but they can't take it in. It literally does turn him into this little kid. And obviously Simon's now got his son, which is, you know, these things change every, you know, things change you, don't they? So I think that as well has softened Simon a bit. But he just loves good magic. And if you listen to him, he often says it has to be more than the magic. It has to have like a hook or an emotional hook to it, especially an emotional hook.
Yeah.
You know, and if you watched the ones that did it this year, like brilliantly with James and Dylan. So, you know, if you watch that semi-final, that was such a well-constructed piece of magic, and the scripting and the whole, if you watch how Ashley Banjo was genuinely affected by that trick and how we did it with the photos, and the pictures ended up spelling the name of his son, you know, and that kind of thing, when you're without being schmaltzy, that's the most important thing, is because we're British, we have a break on, generally there's a break on all of that, hopefully, where it doesn't cross the line of being touching to being schmaltzy and you know, over the top. And like I said about the sob stories, I'm not a fan, you know, I'm not a fan of that kind of thing at all. And I've never really, the only one I would say, and it isn't a sob story at all, it's a true thing, and that was Mark Spellman's act when he first went on, and that was the thing based around his wife and his daughter, and I know he meant it, and I know Mark's a mate, and I know from his Facebook he had gone through all this horrible stuff, and it ended up as a positive and inspiring story, you know. Was it something I would do? No. If it was me, that's not my thing, but I totally understood where he was coming from, and I know he meant it. You know, it was a great audition as well, and it kind of worked on many levels, you know. So I'd say that's the only one. And in fairness, you know, that's Mark's. You know, Mark, what I did was I kind of scripted it with him and blocked it and shortened it and made it work for TV. You know, that sounds dodgy, doesn't it? Made it work within the show. And that's the other thing. Just quickly, the big thing on BGT that was why I got involved was I wanted them to respect magic, but I also was tired of watching the TV magic with all the edits, and where we were cheating, and I still hate it. I hate pre-show. I have this real thing pre-show. I just hate pre-show. And luckily on the show, because it's a competition and there's £250,000 at stake, the act has to start when the act walks out on stage. So if you did pre-show, that you've got an advantage there. You're already the act started half an hour earlier.
Yeah.
And I just don't like it. I think it's, you know, we are deceivers and we do cheat, but you know, there's a certain level that to me of like a pride in what you do. And we've never used pre-show ever. Okay. And I hope not to. And I also think that, because we're legit, the magic is legit, it gives it a different look to all the other TV magic, because everyone's editing, everyone's, you know. I remember when Jamie Raven did Cartoon, there's that moment where there's a move, isn't there? Can't remember, but there's a move to get the card in position, and it's totally logical. And they rang me, and I said, and I remember the producer ringing me, saying, "I don't know why I'm ringing you, because we've never done this before." Well, I'm ringing you to tell you we've edited that move. And I was like, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, That way it can't be backtracked on YouTube. And that is the exact thing that these magicians say nowadays. Like, it can't, oh, we do it because then it can't be backtracked on you. It's like, don't, so naive. It's like you could go do a Google search on cartoon card trick and you'll find the trick. You know, it's just bullshit. And realized that one of the production must have worked on one of these shows because it was literally verbatim what I was being told by magicians that were working on those shows, that it was a legitimate, that was the reason. And I was so angry that they edited that move out. And then I remember when they did it, there was those same people were going, oh, Russ Stevens, he says all this and then he does it. And it's like, no, I didn't do it. And I hate the fact that you magicians, you've created that situation for me. Like, I've had a trick ruined for me. And to be honest, Craig, that move is where you spread the deck face up, isn't it? And
yeah, you up jog the selection.
Put it on the face. But for me, that moment is the only time they see the deck is when you that move face up. So if you look at the BGT performance, it's great, but you never see the cards ever. And to me, that's a strong moment. Look, it's a deck of cards. They're in order, but it's a deck of cards and they're all different. And that got removed because they clearly had that little bit of knowledge of that that was a move. Well, we can cut that out.
Yeah.
And to me, it actually weakened the effect because you didn't see the deck, you know.
But you wouldn't let that happen anymore now that you're in the position that you're in.
No, there are some things where, you know, like on the audition process, the magic is as it is. I can't be too so involved. On the live shows is where I really am involved massively. On the audition process, it's very much the act, you know, and I'll be there to watch stuff. But on the edit, I can't. There was a thing that happened on one of the acts this year, which a couple of magicians picked up on, but most people missed it, where you did see something. And that upset me greatly, but I'm not in that position at that point in the show to do it. When I get to the lives and the semi-final where the production are in, where I do get completely involved in it all, I can say, I get the edit. So they'll send me the edit 2 days before it airs just to look through it and check that it's okay.
Got it.
So yeah, which is a massive deal, you know, at BGT to for them to have that trust is like,
well, just the fact that they have asked you to work with them shows that they have a very big respect for magic.
Yeah.
If they didn't care, honestly, they wouldn't be hiring you to work with them.
Yeah, honestly, like I know, you know, I always say it's an easy reputation to lose. That it's been 7 years of building this reputation of that if people want to come on the show now, that they feel safe, you know, that they, and if you're bad, you're bad. You know, it's still a competition and you could go on it and make yourself look an idiot, but their intent is not to make you look an idiot. You know, if anyone goes on there and comes out not going, there was an act this year, it was a magic thing and it was kind of their kindness made things worse because the act wasn't great and it was sad because the judges were like, at the end saying, it's such a shame because you're such lovely people. You're so nice. And it made it even, their niceness made it worse, you know, but they weren't taking the mickey like they would have done in the past, you know. So it's my thing now is if anyone is thinking of BGT, it's still a really positive time. Magic is still massive on the show. I keep hearing from magicians, the odd magician going, oh, it's burnt out now. And yeah, you know, next year, that's it. As long as magic is done, as long as we do it differently and we've not had that before in that way, it will be refreshing to the public. And luckily for magic, we can do that. You know, with a bit of thought and creativity, you can do it.
Now, I want to pick up on one thing. Before we wrap things up, Russ, I want to pick up on one thing that you've talked about throughout this interview, which is young magicians. You've talked about working with Izzy Simpson, and I know you've worked with Jasper and Aidan and everyone else. And obviously you were a young magician at one point as well.
I'm really glad you brought that up because this has turned into quite a thing for me. So when Izzy did it, it was like I said earlier, it was an unplanned kind of thing. But on a personal level, I think even if Izzy hadn't been my granddaughter, it would have been like, a very kind of, for me personally, a satisfying Yeah, it's that same endeavor. The whole thing was so positive because with a kid, you don't yet have the ego. You don't have the, obviously an adult goes on to BGT for a reason. You know, the kids, all they want, you know, Izzy just wanted to go on BGT because James Moore, Darcy Oak and Jamie Raven had been on it. And it was on Saturday night. It was a big part of her life. And wouldn't it be a dream to audition? And, you know, that was enough for her. You know, there was never any. And then when we actually did end up doing it, I don't know, two or three months later, it was, you know, beyond anything expected kind of thing. So I saw the positivity it gave Izzy. And then, I got a message one day from someone on my Facebook from a non-magician, a family whose son had autism and in Ireland, and they wanted to meet, Izzy had inspired him, like, completely. So to get into, he was into magic, but he'd really been inspired by Izzy, and he wanted to meet Izzy. So I arranged for them to meet up, and his name's Killian, and he's now one of this little group of kids. So last Blackpool, there were four of them. There was Izzy, Aidan, who just did it, the little Irish boy who was on the final, Jasper, who got to the final, and Killian, who hopefully I'd love to try and work with as well. And and they did a little talk at the convention just from their kids in magic, you know, and that's the most satisfying thing to me, because the BGT thing has been like absolutely amazing in a lot of ways, like on a personal level, but also, you know, there's negativity that comes with that. When you're working with adults, you've got aspirations and you've got ego and you've got, you know, sometimes it can bring out the unpleasant side in people, where it's a, you know, there are levels to which you want to go to achieve a success, which I never had personally, because I just always worked. I was lucky that I just always worked, and I didn't realize, you know, how some people can be. So, but working with the kids like really made up for anything else. So Aidan and Jasper this year were great. And I hope to carry it on. You know, I want to build up a little group of kids that, like, this year we brought them to the convention, and there was Ben, who was a little American boy who we flew over. We paid for him to come over, and he did the international close-up. He's really brilliant. And that I get like a massive buzz off, because I remember the night of Arturo show on the Saturday night in Blackpool, we went in and saw the show, which was, by the way, like one of the best magic convention shows, I think, theatre shows I'll see. And we came out kind of buzzing because it was just so brilliant. And I remember being with Duncan and my wife in the bar and looking down, and I took a photo, and all the kids were sat, you know how busy that bar is, and they're sat on the floor with their cards out, just absolutely oblivious to anyone else. Wow. Totally in their friendship, you know, not just magic. In there, and bizarrely, I took a photo of them a week or so ago, where Jasper and Aidan were on the final, and Izzy had come down to record this Christmas special. So on that day of the final, so I take a photo of them there, and literally they don't know. I'm just taking a snap, and there they are with their cards out, totally engrossed. And it isn't just doing the tricks; it's like they're mates, like really good friends, you know, and they support each other as well, genuinely, with a real proper heart, no ego. And it's that, to me, is like that's the best magic of BGT. So, and I hope, yeah, that my big plan is to carry that on every year, to build up that thing. And because I've seen the positivity it gives Izzy, and I've seen the positivity it's given Jasper, who was quite introverted as a kid, and Aidan, who's a naturally talented little performer. Mm-hmm. And it's just so positive. Like the Izzy thing, you know, after BGT, she did everything you could ever want from Got Talent. So, and we flew out to the States like several times, you know, to the Ellen show and little big shows, Jimmy Fallon, and we had meetings. We had meetings with people like Steven Spielberg, J.J. Abrams' office. We had the head of casting at Sony Pictures. It was like, looking back, it was mad. But I appreciate, at the time it was mad, but now looking back, it was even madder. And we, you know, Izzy did the show, and how life-changing it can be is that Izzy did the show on the, I think it was the Sunday that year, it was aired live, and she did the show on the Sunday, and the Monday morning my daughter rang and said, oh, I've had a really weird call from, it was Amanda Holden's PA, saying a lady called Sue Latimer is going to give you a call today, and Amanda says, take the call. And so I go on Google and I'm Sue Latimer, and it's Daniel Radcliffe's manager. And so I said, oh, that's really cool, because we based a lot of Izzy's thing around Harry Potter. And I thought, that's really cool. They're going to like arrange for her to meet Daniel Radcliffe. And that, you know, that would have been just amazing. And she rang back, my daughter rang back a few hours later and said, I've just spoken to her and she wants us to come down to London for a meeting. She wants to manage Izzy. So it was like, what? Like, what? You know, and that's how all those film meetings happened and a lot of the stuff, you know, and being backstage at the Ellen show, and she flew in from New York, and we're sitting there and Izzy went off to get her makeup on or whatever was going on. And I remember Sue going, oh, if I give Dan a call now and get him to phone me in 5 minutes, would that put Izzy off? And I'm like, no, she'd love it. So I filmed it on my phone in the dressing room where Sue's phone rang. She said, oh, Izzy, there's someone wants to say hi. And it was Daniel Radcliffe, which at that time for Izzy was the, you know, number one in the world. So she was like all goo-goo over all of that. So stuff like that with the kids, giving those experiences to them and like knowing that I kind of helped to make that happen is like, you know, mega, whether it's Izzy or Aiden or Jasper or Killian or any other kids, that's like a massive buzz, you know.
So if you're a kid or you're a parent of a child,
yes,
what advice would you give?
I'd like really encourage them. Make sure, you know, and that they genuinely love magic. That's like the most important thing. And not push them at all. And like I say, Jasper was very introvert and still is. You know, if you look at him on stage, you compare him and Aiden, they're like chalk and cheese. They're just so different. But they both kind of work in their own. Jasper reminds me of very much a Dynamo. Like, really like Dynamo. That, yeah, kind of like, yeah, that style. Yeah. And whereas Aiden is a performer. He chats. He can, like, he's just got that thing going on. And it's the same thing Izzy's got as well. But it's great because they're all different to each other. So that's like my plan would be, it would be great to have like this group of kids that benefit, whether they stay in magic or not. You know, whether Izzy stayed in magic, if she's no longer doing it in 5 years, which I don't think she will, she'll still always be interested. But the positive thing from doing that, like the most recent one with Izzy was she's obsessed with musicals. Like, obsessed. So she knows, if you know Hamilton, the musical, like it's a rap. She like knows nearly all those songs verbatim. Wow. So she's, but all of them, like, so when we realized that Cameron McIntosh was doing the final for BGT, we had this whole Les Miserables, Phantom, and what was the other one? Les Miserables, Phantom. Anyway, there were three musicals. Oh, Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins, that's it.
Well, that's like his idea of heaven. And it was a closed set. And I put it on my Facebook, and my daughter put it on her private thing saying, is that one of the best moments of her life, was filming Izzy's face with the visor on, watching 2 hours of like dress rehearsal right up close, you know, and then meeting, I don't know, Carrie Hope Fisher is apparently, she's like, well, I think that's her name. She's the lead in Les Miserables, and Izzy, you know, completely goo-goo, and I said, excuse me, this is my granddaughter Izzy, could I get a photo? And Izzy was like, ah, you know, and giving her those opportunities, it's amazing. And for Jasper and Aiden, seeing the positivity of doing BGT, that's like, well, that's proper magic, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. And it's great to see what you're doing with the youngsters in magic. It's absolutely brilliant, Russ.
Yeah, it's good. It's cool. That's the best part. And it wasn't a planned thing either. That's just happened. And seeing how positive it was for Izzy in her life, and then being able to do it with, well, now two kids this year, and hopefully in the future as well, you know, it's really good. Like, that's the thing that I know I'll look back on, and even now I look back on Izzy's thing and go, wow, that was like, what an amazing thing for her to be lucky enough to experience that.
I can tell just by speaking to you how passionate you are about it as well, which is just great to see.
Good, thanks. Yeah, it's an important thing.
Now, I know you've got to go soon, so can I ask you one other question? Completely off subject, but also something that you have revolutionised. You know, you've revolutionised BGT, and you've been doing the same thing with the Blackpool Magic Convention.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd love to talk about that very, very quickly.
Because... Really quick. So we basically, the whole thing of how Blackpool was run a few years ago changed. And Russ Brown, who I mentioned earlier, Guy Barrett and myself, kind of suddenly, we didn't find ourselves in that position. We kind of suggested it. And we now have this team at Blackpool Magic Club, probably about 12 of us, I think. But it's a really great team of people that all have this one thing in mind, which is to put on a brilliant magic convention. And that totally is it. And luckily they gave us that, you know, luckily for the club as well, that like we're members. So I'm a member and my skills are staging and directing and Russell's skills are similar. And Russ stage manages all the gala shows. So he like runs them backstage properly. Guy is all like the logistics and also the creative as well. So we're a really good little team of three. And then behind us, we've got this amazing team of people that are also members that kind of make it all happen for us as well, you know, on the logistical side and whatever. So that's like a really fun thing for us. So outside of my work with BGT, and Russ is normally prior pandemic, like super busy with his thing like you are. And we find this fun thing, which sometimes isn't fun, but most of the time it is. It's a fun thing to put on this blooming convention, and the numbers have gone like through the roof. We've been doing it since about 2017. So
it was my first Blackpool back this year. I hadn't been there for about 5 or 6 years. And it was my first Blackpool back, and I was blown away. It was completely different.
Again, the thing of if you've been like the positivity. My thing is the atmosphere. Yep. Like, you know, I don't get a chance to wander around because we're running around like idiots putting on the bloody shows and rehearsing and all of that. But when I do go out, you feel this it's such a positive vibe. Like, it's such a positive vibe of people. I don't know, it just seems to be, it's just changed. To me, it's changed. It's like, I think our aim was always to make the shows better. That was my first aim, was like, these shows need to be produced properly and let's bring in, like, you know, Arturo with his full show. And I remember when we announced that, someone put on our page, like, I haven't paid whatever the price is, 100 and whatever pounds, to see a man standing doing quick change for an hour and a half, you know. And I thought, yeah, little do you know. And, you know, the effort that it took to get people like Lance Burton and Arturo to, you know, Lance Burton was 3 years of like covertly badgering him to just agree to do the convention was, you know, for me, he's one of my heroes as well. So for all of us, actually, the three of us. So just that alone, the effort and work, and Arturo's show, you know, Guy went to Milan to see the show, but more to explain to Arturo how much we wanted it for the reasons that we wanted it. We didn't, you know, we just wanted to show everyone how brilliant stage magic can be. And I think we're lucky enough because I think we hit I think it was 4,900 and something people. We were just about four people under 5,000. So that was our aim, was to hit five. And that allows us, budget-wise, to be able to book Lance Burton. And Arturo's show was three Pantechnic trucks from Italy. You know, it's like bloody expensive. You know, I mean, if you knew the costs, and then we still read people moaning about queuing up to get in, which I kind of understand the frustration. But when you've got 5,000 people getting in, you're not going to get them in like we used to. You know, and we will in subsequent years, hopefully we're learning as we go as well. So, you know, we're not event organisers as such, but I think we're a smart group, a smart team of people that are learning as we go. So we've kind of been a bit victim of our success in that respect. But I think the convention now, and it's just so tragic about the pandemic, but we kind of went out with a bang this year that I don't know how we can top it, because we will, because Blackpool for me is all about the social and the dealers, they're the stars of the show. Mm-hmm. And the lectures and the shows are not secondary, but they're not as important to me as the social. And that was what was always important to us, that we wanted this friendly atmosphere, which we felt kind of wasn't there before. Mm-hmm. It was friendly, but now it just seems so like buzzing. There's a buzz. That's it.
Yeah,
that's the
thing. It was.
There's a buzz now at Blackpool, and it wasn't really there before. And it's been 3 years now where, and I do think it is, you know, I want people to go into that, into the Opera House, like really buzzing, looking forward to the show. Not just like, oh, it's going to be a good show tonight. Like, but what are they doing this year? Or what, you know, what, you know, the production. I mean, yeah. I mean, if magicians knew just how much money we spend on production in that theatre, you know, it's the cheapest, best bargain in magic, Blackpool Magic Convention. Seriously, it's unbelievable. Like, it's because it isn't run like other magic conventions that are businesses. It is a limited company. We are a business, and yeah, we make a profit, but we don't run it in the way that we have to. You know, we want to make 50% of the ticket sale goes to us, because that isn't how it works. It's the Blackpool Magic Club that own that convention and run it, and so it's kind of almost like the socialist magic convention, if there's such a thing, because yeah, it isn't run. We're running it as a business now, but we're running it as a business for the Blackpool Club, not for an individual person or the three of us. You know, it's very, and that's, I think that's the key to that convention, is that we, that allows us to not say we want 50% of your ticket price goes in our pocket, because that isn't how it's run.
Well, you, Ruff and Guy, are all successful in your own right. You don't need to.
No, we don't. And genuinely, we don't. But we do have a passion for it. And we also, like with BGT, with the convention, I always knew it could be so much better than it was. And it was kind of stuck in a bit of a rut. And I was really, it was kind of good when we got given that free rein, really, to just go, yeah, within reason, guys. You know, go for it. Just do what you think should be best. And I don't think we didn't do it this year, but I remember one year we had like a street magician, the silent guy, who's brilliant. And he just rocked up in the piazza and just like a busker would and started performing. And he had his stuff backstage, but I made him come through the main entrance like he would with his trolley and his speaker and just rock up and start busking, to the point that another couple of magicians later in the weekend thought that he was genuinely just another registrant doing his thing. And then they decided that they would start doing a bit of street performing as well. So that kind of thing was a really positive vibe. Do you know what I mean?
That's great. Yeah. And you obviously made the difficult decision to postpone 2021. It's not happening for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Have you already started working on 2022?
Yeah, well, we'd obviously put Chris Angel for 2021. That was all that deal done, and we were all ready to go. So our plan is that and we'd already booked like a lot of stuff for 21 already. So our plan is to pretty much, and everyone has been so positive and nice that's already involved in 21, is we're hoping to carry that over to 22, hoping that we can. And it's been, what's been really encouraging is we obviously started selling tickets literally on the midnight of last convention ending. And so a lot of the VIP, well, the VIP tickets sold out immediately. And the VIP tickets nowadays with Blackpool, when you book your ticket, you book your seat for the shows, which is really great. So it isn't a free for all. You've got your seat. You've got to get it early. Book early, you'll get the best seats. And the VIP seats are obviously the best seats. And those VIP tickets, there have been so few people that have asked for a refund. For us, that's what a great thing. And to everyone out there that's booked, you know, thanks for your support, because so few people have actually asked for refunds. They just want to keep their seat for 2022, which is a very positive way to end this chat, isn't it? Because it's a really good thing that they obviously like the convention and they want to come back. And please God that this pandemic ends in some way or another.
Yes, I really hope it will, and I'm sure it will. And you know, we'll look back at this one day, and we'll look back and remember. Oh, do you remember 2020? Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
the year that wasn't. But Russ, I really want to say thanks very much. I know you're really busy. I know you've got to shoot onto another Zoom now, but I want to say thanks very much for
think I missed it, Craig. No, it's all right. I'm good. I'll.
Seven. Sorry.
My phone was binging earlier, and I've just put it to silent. So it's all right. I'll jump on that now. But thank you very much.
Thanks, Russ. I really appreciate it. I'm going to put your contact details down there for both RSVP. I encourage people to look at your back catalogue.
Thank you.
Also, if people want to speak to you about BGT and they're serious.
Yeah, serious. Yeah. Right. You know, I'm just messaging me on Facebook. That's probably the easiest way. I'm constantly looking at that stuff. So
amazing. Russ,
thank you.
On behalf of the community, thanks for what you're doing for Magic. I really appreciate it.
Cheers, Craig.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV. Or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.